Hello, welcome to the Saturn edition of your local talking newspaper covering St Albans and the surrounding district. This edition is for the week ending October 17th, 2020. My name is Alex, I'm the editor of the programme. Due to the coronavirus, it is no longer safe to record together in our studio, so this edition is being produced from home. I'm joined remotely from their homes by Kalpana, Peter, Alison and Claire, who will be reading the news, and John, who will be reading the radio listings. A massive thank you to them for helping out in these circumstances. The piece of music you have just heard is called Prairie Song, and we will play all of it at the end of this recording. As usual, our thanks go to Goffby, who composed the music and has given us permission to use it. All the news items in this recording have been taken from the Hearts Advertiser, and we will finish with a summary of the radio programmes we think you might enjoy over the next week. Here is Kalpana with the first news item.
Hello, this is Kalpana Block. It's official. We're among the UK's thirstiest folk. Water consumption in the St Albans district is higher than almost anywhere else in the UK, putting a massive drain on rare local chalk streams. Findings by Affinity Water show each person uses about 150 litres of water a day. That's 10 litres more than the UK average. This is affecting the rivers Ver and Colne, which are under threat from high levels of water extraction. Now, residents are being urged to save 10 litres of water each daily, leaving 1 million extra in the environment, roughly 2 minutes of the tap on full as part of the hashtag Save10ADay campaign. Jake Rigg, Director of Corporate Affairs and Communities for Affinity Water, said, "We're asking everyone in St Albans District to save 10 litres of water a day. We've made it really easy. All you need to do is sign up for a getwaterfit.co.uk for your free water saving kit. Simply install it and you'll be saving water, protecting the River Ver and reducing local carbon emissions." We don't know exactly why St Albans water usage is high, but we're determined to work with our customers to reduce it. If every household joins in and installs a kit, together we'll save a huge 1 million litres a day. St Albans MP Daisy Cooper is backing the campaign. She said, "Residents in St Albans often ask me what they can do to tackle the climate crisis, so I'm really pleased to support this Save 10 a Day campaign as a practical step that every household can take. The River Ver and Colne are two of only 200 precious chalk streams in the world, yet they are under threat from climate change and the high levels of local water usage. Now we can all do our bit to help protect this valuable asset for future generations by reducing our water consumption. I will be doing my bit, both in Parliament and at home, to return our precious rivers to their former glory." Council leader Councillor Chris White, portfolio holder for Climate, Environment and Transport, said, "I'm surprised the district's water consumption is above the national average, given the huge support there is for environmental action. This is an important campaign that gives our residents the chance to do something about it, and I'm sure they will commit to it. I will be signing up to get my free water saving kit with the aim of saving 10 litres a day, and I urge everyone else to do so." Chalk artist Zoe Andrews has been prompted by the campaign to do pavement sketches in Harpenden and Verulamium Park, showing different mammals, birds, insects and fish living in the Ver chalk stream. She said, "My business started during lockdown with the aim of bringing joy and community spirit in a time of need. So it feels great to be able to do something, not only to bring the community together once again, but also to help the local environment at the same time." Karen Snook, who runs St Albans Mum's Facebook group, is one of the 600 people who have already signed up. She said, "I'm so excited about this campaign. It's perfectly in line with our community ethos. We've signed up to www.getwaterfit.co.uk. It was so easy, my 14-year-old did it for us. It's so interesting looking at where in our home we use the most water and how we compare to the national average. I've ordered our water savings kit and my kids have pledged to turn off the tap when they brush their teeth and to be quicker in the shower. They really love that by saving water, they're raising money for local charities and their school. The campaign aims to raise £10,000 for 6 local charities, which will be selected by supporters. You can share your photos of the chalk trail by using the tag #save10aday, and Affinity Water will add a further £1 to its charity fund for every post.
Hello, this is Peter Block, and my first article this week is A Decade in Business for Baby Whisperer. Navitha Holland opened high-end maternity and newborn photography studio, Peekaboo Studios, on October the 10th, 2010. After leaving her job in marketing to pursue her lifelong dream, Navitha found her specialty, photographing newborns under 10 days old. She said, "I simply cannot believe I've been running my successful multi-award winning business for exactly 10 years now. How wonderful to have the birth of my business fall on 10, 10, 10, and now exactly 10 years later, here I am, cracking open the champagne." Malcolm Macmillan, chairman of London Coney Parish Council, said, "It is wonderful when a small business in our community achieves national recognition and gets itself on the UK map alongside London Coney." Navina's recognition has spiralled with clients coming from far and wide, culminating in many prestigious national awards. The service she offers was even awarded Best Customer Service in the Nation Best Businesswoman Awards a few years ago, which recognised her business acumen, determination, creativity and tenacity. "We've had a catalogue of wonderful testimonials from Navina's local clients. People love what she does and we love her too. To celebrate, Navitha will be launching a brand new website, www.peekabustudios.co.uk, as well as competitions for free sessions, newly branded uniform, and behind-the-scenes video of how shoot sessions work. To further celebrate the occasion and mark the launch of her new fine art style of portraiture, she's designed a unique and exclusive style of photographic backdrop, which has been aptly named Peekaboo Olive, working closely with Click Props CEO Charlie Kaufman." Ray Lowe, chairman of the Master Photographers Association, said, "10 years to be running any business in this day and age is remarkable, but in a business which gives so much pleasure to the public is even more special. I have seen Navitha grow over the last few years into one of the top studio portrait photographers in our industry. She consistently wins top awards, proving her peers' respect for her outstanding work." And this piece is accompanied with some of the portrait work that Navitha has produced over the years, and they are indeed very stylish.
Hello, this is Alison. My first story has the headline, MP Cooper pledges her support to Build Back Better campaign. St Albans' Daisy Cooper has welcomed a grassroots campaign calling for a green and fair coronavirus recovery plan. Build Back Better St Albans wants to see a programme which protects public services, tackles inequality in our communities, provides secure, well-paid jobs, and creates a shockproof economy which can fight the climate crisis. They presented Daisy with a letter signed by more than 20 local organisations urging her to write to the Chancellor and the Prime Minister to implore them to consider a fair and sustainable recovery from the COVID-19 crisis. Chris Allen, founder of the St Albans Build Back Better campaign, said, "We're hoping that Daisy's new position as deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats will give her an even better platform to push forward these values. With groups in other constituencies doing the same across the UK, hopefully we might see some tangible policy changes which benefit the most disadvantaged in our society." Daisy responded, I'm grateful to the organisations that have signed this letter. It shows the strength of feeling in our community that our nation builds back better after COVID-19. It highlights a growing consensus that urgent and ambitious action is needed to tackle the climate emergency. We now have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, both to combat the looming tragedy of mass unemployment due to COVID-19 and to reshape the economy on more environmental lines. Liberal Democrats propose investing $150 billion over 3 years to deliver the green revolution we need to transform the economy. We want to see a green jobs guarantee to train people in new environmental industries such as renewable energy, insulating homes and rewilding projects, while ensuring they're paid at least the national living wage. The crisis gives us a chance to do things differently, to build a fairer society and a greener economy. By kickstarting large-scale investment in energy efficiency, starting with social housing, we can help reach our green energy targets, create jobs in supply chains, and help those most affected by fuel poverty. As requested by these local organisations, I will be writing to the Chancellor and the Prime Minister to urge them to build back better.
Hello, this is Claire speaking. My first article today is about Batchwood Golf Course. Wayward golf ball mayhem for Batchwood neighbours prompts course hole review. Golfers using the ninth hole at St Albans District Council-owned Batchwood Golf Course are apparently responsible for driving wild shots into residential properties, prompting the course managers to consider alternative options, including bringing in a consultant to examine the layout of the hole. One resident of Batchwood Drive, who did not want to be named, fears the council may remove the hole completely and said there should be proper consultation before any decision is made. I know that there are a lot more important things in life, especially with the coronavirus going on. I just think that there should be a proper consultation with local residents, golfers and members of the club before anything is decided. He added that if people buy a house near a golf course, they might expect to see the occasional golf ball land in their garden, but that should not mean a major replanning of Batchwood as a result. Tony Marmo, acting head of commercial and development for St Albans Council, said, "We are reviewing the ninth hole because wayward golf balls struck from the tee have been leaving the course occasionally and landing in nearby gardens. This was happening only every couple of months or so, but there have been more instances in recent weeks as the course has become busier following the lockdown. We are looking at a range of options to prevent this with the help of a golf course consultant. We've also been meeting with our leisure contractor, One Life, which manages the course, as well as Batchwood Golf Club members to discuss the way forward. No decisions will be made until our consultations have finished and we have considered all the feedback." Batchwood Golf Course was developed by St Albans Council in 1935 when John Henry Taylor was commissioned to design and establish an 18-hole golf course in the grounds of Batchwood Hall. And there's an image accompanying the article which shows a drone's eye view of golfers at Batchwood.
Survey: law-breaking drivers should get higher fines. Hertfordshire residents ask for higher fines for drivers breaking the law to pay for road safety improvements. More than 10,000 people in the county responded to the survey by the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners, which attracted 66,000 replies nationally. Over two-thirds of respondents, or 70% to be precise, reported seeing traffic offences, such as speeding or using a mobile phone, on a daily or weekly basis, with the same number of respondents wanting fixed penalty notices for speeding and not wearing a seatbelt doubled to £200. 9 out of 10 respondents wanted money raised through fixed penalty notices to be reinvested into enforcement and road safety measures to deny criminals the use of the roads. Presently, money from speed camera fines goes to central government for general expenditure rather than directly to the police. Hertfordshire Police and Crime Commissioner David Lloyd said, "I would like to thank everyone who took time to complete this survey. Road safety is a major concern to everyone in both urban and rural areas. This was an opportunity to ensure people worked with my office and other commissioners across the country to ensure the Department of Transport heard their views. It is clear that people want tougher action taken against speeders, mobile phone users, and those who don't wear seatbelts. They also want more money reinvested from fines to make further improvements to road safety. The survey, the largest ever conducted by the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners, will be used to influence a Department of Transport consultation on roads policing, which closed this week. The results come as the new Department for Transport figures show that 1,752 people were killed in Great Britain last year in road crashes, and of these, 287 were children and young people. David Lloyd went on to say, although a 2% drop on the previous year, the number of fatalities has remained broadly similar year on year since 2010, which followed a period of substantial reductions in casualties. Motorists already pay vehicle excise duty, which is linked to greenhouse gases, and this is also put in the general pot of taxation.
This news item has the title, Estimates that virus will cost the County Council £70 million. New financial estimates are predicting that the coronavirus pandemic will cost Hearts County Council more than £70 million by the end of the financial year. As a result, the council is now preparing for an overspend in excess of £17 million as the result of COVID-19. At the meeting, councillors were told there were hopes it would reduce to around £12 million should the council receive £6 million from the government towards the loss of income. The council's forecast include the millions in additional expenditure already incurred to deliver essential services, as well as dedicated response projects during the pandemic. They also include forecasts of additional pandemic-related expenditure, loss of income, and unachieved specific savings that have been planned for this year. They do also take into account underspends, including the furlough of music service employees, postage, business mileage, and printing costs. Central government has already allocated £54.5 million to the County Council towards the cost of COVID-19, with some further funding expected to address the loss of income. And that, according to a report presented to a meeting of the County Council Resources and Performance Cabinet panel last week, Thursday the 1st of October, points to an expected shortfall of around £17 million. However, the report states that forecast is still extremely volatile with numerous uncertainties and could fluctuate by millions of pounds in a positive or negative direction. Overall, the department expected to have incurred the greatest cost by the end of the financial year is adult care services, where the total additional pressure is said to be £37.2 million. Most of this relates to the continued support for commissioned care providers who can claim back additional costs associated with COVID-19. The council's figures do not include a forecast cost of £18.8 million to support hospital discharges, which is expected to be fully funded by the CCG. Nor do they include the expected fall in revenue from council tax and business rates, although this is expected to impact on the County Council in 21-22. If no further funding is made available, the financial losses forecast this year will be met from the Council's contingency budget and from reserves.
The next story has the title, Imagine a mini river flowing onto your terrace. Concern over constant floods in close. Harpenden residents are finding themselves in deep water as rain persistently poses a flood threat to their homes. Hyde Close suffers from two major difficulties at the moment, and they've both been going on for a long time, said Carol Hedges, whose home backs on to Hyde Close. The first one is the fact that the two drains are blocked. Because the council have built this cycle path extension in Westfield Road, all the water from the main Westfield Road funnels into Hyde Close. We have a major source of water just coming in, as well as the water that would just fall naturally. If you combine that with the two blocked drains, then you've got a major flooding every time there's a torrential downpour or long-term heavy rain. Mrs. Hedges, who has lived on parallel Cold Harbour Lane for 33 years, said, "We've had to build flood barriers at the back of our house with fertiliser sacks and wood. When there is a big bad storm, we're up all night checking if the water's coming in. We just don't feel secure." Carol and her husband Martin, who are both in their 70s, have been pushing water away from their home, which is physically taxing work. Imagine a mini river flowing onto your terrace and threatening to come into your kitchen and your living room. We have to sweep the water around the side of the house and out down the side gate onto the street, and we're doing that for hours. It was just about doable in the summer. I'm not sure it's going to be in the depths of winter. The couple are considering taking legal action against the council. A spokesperson for Herts County Council said, "Our highway engineers are aware of the flooding problems in Hyde Close and have visited the site on several occasions to see the problem for themselves, speak to residents, and investigate the cause of the flooding. Unfortunately, following these investigations, it is clear that this is not a simple problem we can fix quickly, and we've had to order in specialist equipment to carry out a more detailed survey of the drainage system in the area. We know that this flooding is a serious concern for residents, and sorting it out is a priority for us. While there is no quick solution, we're working hard to fix this and make sure that residents and local councillors are being kept up to date on progress."
My next article is about how businesses have been rated compliant with virus rules without having inspections. Data obtained by the Herts Advertiser revealed 64% of St Albans premises spot-checked by the National Health and Safety Executive, HSE, were only questioned by telephone. But Mandy McNeil, portfolio holder for business at St Albans Council, reassured residents that council officers were working 24/7 and at weekends to help businesses protect staff and customers. She said, "I'm horrified but not surprised. It's pretty stunning what's going on nationally, but locally our team have been bending over backwards." Between June and August, the HSE spot-checked 11 workplaces in St Albans, but the Advertiser has discovered only 4 of them received site visits. The rest were subjected to remote spot checks conducted by phone. The revelation came as infection rates continued to rise across the UK, including in St Albans. When the Advertiser took its findings to council leader Chris White, he said, "You're kidding me. I'm astonished. I'm absolutely stunned. I mean, if it weren't so serious, it would be funny. It's not even worth a phone call, in my view. What sort of answer are they likely to get to a phone conversation like that? No, we are not compliant, actually. I think it's all a big conspiracy. Go away. That's not going to happen, is it? It's deeply concerning. This is another part of the nation's COVID infrastructure that's not even close to working properly. I will certainly be raising it with MPs and national organisations." Councillor McNeil said she had received a handful of complaints about businesses breaking COVID-19 rules, mostly relating to national chains. "They are typically not about businesses which are part of our independent hospitality and retail association," she said. An HSE spokesperson said the telephone calls were made by specially trained operators who follow a set of questions compiled by HSE experts on COVID compliance. It said it ensured standards were met by visiting a number of the businesses who have told us they have all the right measures in place. "This ensures what we are being told is happening in practice." This article is accompanied by images of St Albans Council Leader Chris White and Business Portfolio Holder Mandy McNeil.
Spooky fun is heading to the Maltings this October half term with the return of the annual Halloween celebrations. This year's festivities include a Halloween scavenger hunt, with participants in with a chance of winning a Halloween hamper from Hotel Chocolat. Children are encouraged to dress up for the event, which has been adapted to meet COVID guidelines. Phil Corrigan, Maltings Centre Manager, said, "Our trick-or-treat event has been incredibly popular over the years and has seen many children taking part. So much so that although we couldn't run the same event, we wanted to offer some kind of Halloween activity. The scavenger hunt is both fun and safe, and we hope our local families join in and enjoy the event just as much as trick or treat. The event will run throughout half term from October the 26th to October the 31st, with final entries to be submitted by the last day of the hunt.
Arrests made after dog thefts. Detectives investigating the theft of a number of dogs from a Bedfordshire kennel have made a further three arrests. Two men and a woman from the St Albans area were arrested on Monday, October the 5th, on suspicion of burglary in connection with the incident in Wildon last month. 12 dogs were also found at the property. Detective Inspector Natalie Fletcher said, "This is a positive result, and we are now working to establish who these dogs belong to, as we suspect they have been stolen." With an increase in dog thefts across the region, dog owners are encouraged to make sure their pets are microchipped with up-to-date details. The arrests came as part of a joint operation with Hertfordshire Constabulary, which also resulted in two caravans being seized. If your dog has been stolen, report it online or by calling 101. You can also contact your local authority's dog warden in Bedfordshire, Central Bedfordshire or Luton.
The next story is entitled "New Barber Hassan Continues Vince's Legacy." A much-missed St Albans barber is returning to the city to hand over the scissors to his successor. Hassan Chowdhury is a new owner of the Vintage Barber Company, formerly Vince's Barbers, in Keyfield Terrace. He has taken over the business following the retirement of Vince Santonastaso. There's been a lot of inquiries about Vince since he retired. The barbershop is due to reopen in the next few weeks, and I've arranged with Vince to attend the grand opening to celebrate all the work that he has accomplished and give him the goodbyes that he deserves. The father of three has lived in St Albans all his life and attended Marlborough School. Hassan said, "I'm taking on a piece of history. Everyone knows that place. Vince was the fastest barber in the world, not sacrificing quality. He did a great job and was affordable for everyone. We used to go there when we were kids, and this is such a massive deal for me, being able to continue the legacy. I couldn't imagine that barber's as anything other than that. We can't wait to welcome Vince at our opening."
This next article is about Walk to School Week. A five-day walking challenge aimed at primary school pupils helped children put their best foot forward to reaching their recommended 60 minutes minimum of physical activity per day before even reaching the school gates. Year 3 pupils at St John Fisher Primary School in St Albans celebrated the launch of the national initiative by recording their journeys to school on an online tracker. Being active and getting some exercise before school can help set kids up for a positive day. Mrs. Aquino, the lead for citizenship at St John Fisher School, said, "We have really noticed how engaged the children are in trying to achieve the weekly challenge of an active journey every week and receive the much desired monthly badge. The initiative is also helping reduce school traffic by encouraging parents that do need to drive to park further away from the school and to walk the last part so the children are active before school starts." And there's a picture with this article showing year 3 pupils celebrating reaching their daily exercise goal.
Here are the names of people who have recently died, as announced in this week's Hearts Advertiser. Dennis Paul Bozier, aged 80. Anthony Barrett, also known as Tony, aged 81. And Robert Frank Arnold, aged 93. May they rest in peace.
Podcaster Craig makes it to the top 10 shortlist. A St Albans podcaster has been named on a top 10 shortlist of the UK's most popular podcasts. Craig Fields, along with Hemel Hempstead-based David Long, host of Is It Worth It?, has been ranked at number 7 on podcasting platform's Podiant's top 10 most popular podcasts. Craig and David go out of their way to watch the latest films in the cinema to let you know if they are worth seeing. David and I are both incredibly proud to be in Podiant's top 10 UK-hosted podcasts, Craig said. He went on to say, it's almost bittersweet, though. The podcast is all about seeing all the latest cinematic releases, and most of our podcasting team also work for Cineworld. We create lots of different content and adapted during lockdown while the cinema chains were closed, and to great positive reactions. But as Cineworld closed all of their doors, we find the podcast thrown into a state of mourning for our friends and for the industry as a whole. We'd like to take this opportunity to thank Cineworld Hemel Hempstead and their staff on the ground for keeping the cinemas going so we could enjoy the latest releases, and we'll be back once they open. He went on to say that the podcast will continue to make entertaining and engaging content, and we'll bring the latest mobile reviews from all the streaming platforms as we navigate this new world together. The number of Brits creating a podcast in the last 5 months has increased by nearly 14%, based on podcast hosting site Podiant's new trial data, suggesting that the COVID-19 pandemic has also sparked an audio-related transformation. The amount of UK listeners turning to podcasts each week has more than doubled in the last 5 years, amassing around 7.1 million listeners. Podiant founder Mark Steadman said, despite the uncertainty and difficulties faced across the UK during lockdown, people have found alternative ways to connect with each other, channel their creativity, and share their individual voices and experience. We have seen a shift in more people launching a podcast because it can be recorded from anywhere, the bedroom, garden, or even the kitchen. It's something for which you don't need any technical experience. You just need a laptop, your voice, and a story.
This news item has the headline, Council plans for St Peter Street site move forwards. A city centre retail and office block on the market for £7.2 million has been approved for purchase by the council. Councillors voted to approve the acquisition of Lockie House in St Peter Street, the building that currently has Barclays Bank and Virgin Money amongst its tenants. The Cabinet, the Council's executive, approved moves to purchase the freehold of the property back in July, and a significant offer secured its position as the preferred bidder. A meeting of the full council has now approved the decision by 29 to 22 votes, so money will be made available for the purchase, and the council is now completing the legal due diligence prior to exchanging and completing on the sale. The purchase of Lockie House will enable the council to manage the whole area more effectively and to shape the economic mix of the use of shoppers, businesses and residents, whilst also providing future redevelopment options. Adjacent to the building is the CCOS South redevelopment site, which was formerly the site of the police station and NHS clinic, which is being transformed into adjacent blocks of flats and commercial space. It is also intended to create new annual revenue, as the rental income should be more than the repayments for the 50-year loan to buy the building. Councillor Robert Donald, portfolio holder for commercial development and wellbeing, said, "This is a unique opportunity to acquire one of the biggest and most prominent commercial buildings on our high street, which will enable us to protect and support the city's economic life. We believe we should miss this opportunity. But while considering the building as a potentially useful strategic acquisition, the Conservative group voted against buying it, claiming the Lib Dem administration's plans were short-term and did not have the public and high street as their primary focus." Mary Maynard, leader of the opposition at the council, said, "It is a great pity. It could have been a fantastic opportunity to open up an exciting new space that could have been used for a variety of purposes. However, this is not a standalone purchase and must be looked at in terms of the wider picture. This Liberal Democrat-run council is already planning to use 107% loans to fund overambitious property speculation. For example, nearly £19 million to buy up part of the Harpenden High Street at a top of the market price. Even more debt is racking up through project management incompetence. In 18 months, they have delivered nothing and are late on every project and have millions of pounds worth of cost overruns on 6 of the 7 projects currently underway. This acquisition allows them to speculate with a further £7.2 million of local ratepayers' money. Even worse, when questioned, it's clear they have no vision or the passion for what could be achieved on this site and do not seem to understand the way COVID is transforming the way people live, work and shop. District Council leader Chris White responded to these allegations, "I'm astonished that the Conservatives never learn. The debt incurred by the council is largely in relation to the large number of prestigious projects that they chose to embark on while in administration. The Lockie House investment borrowing accounts for less than a quarter of the sums dedicated to the current Harpenden projects, which we are completing in accordance with the expectations of Harpenden residents. The project mismanagement referred to is in relation to the Harpenden projects, which were the Conservatives sought to massage the figures thereby cutting contingency sums allocated from 10% to 2%, contrary to the council's own rulebook. We were landed with the consequences. The Lockie House investment will give an immediate return and amounts to a sound, non-speculative investment as certified by the council's professional advisers, whose opinions the Conservatives have seen."
My last story has the headline, "Why It's Important to Talk About Losing a Baby Child." And it's accompanied by a beautiful picture of the cathedral with the front of the cathedral lit up bright pink and blue. The annual Baby Loss Awareness Week is now in its 18th year, and St Albans Cathedral has been lit up in pink and blue in solidarity with parents who have been affected by baby loss. Caroline Thane reveals her own experiences and how important it is to talk about it. An army of often silent love warriors battle through every day, knowing they didn't get to keep a cherished child. I have lost more than one baby. Although I have 4 living children, and one of my miscarriages was more than 20 years ago, it never leaves you. We need these gestures of hope, acknowledgement, and remembrance which encourage, validate, and support those grieving. Acts like that of St Albans Cathedral send vital healing messages that it's okay to discuss and to mark the losses. For many bereaved parents, every day is Baby Loss Awareness Day, and it's through acknowledging and accepting their devastating grief that a less painful time can come. For many bereaved parents, every day is Baby Loss Awareness Day. And it's through acknowledging and accepting their devastating grief that a less painful time can come. That's not to say we remember so we can go on to forget. We will always remember and don't want to forget. The pain is felt for a long time, with mums often knowing how old their baby would be now and wondering, what if? At whichever age or stage a child dies, whether it's in the womb, during labour, at birth or after, baby loss is a catastrophic tragedy. After my eldest child was born, I suffered a miscarriage of a beautiful baby I never held, will never know, and can only commemorate in a limited way. I remember the joyful positive pregnancy test on holiday and being cautious of any falling rocks as we stood by a cliff face in Cornwall. I recall the moment I realised I was losing my baby soon after bleeding. Irrational feelings of guilt and like I'd failed. I had no control over my miscarriage, but it was a feeling I experienced all the same. I realised I was not to blame, but these are the sorts of confusing, agonising feelings we can go through at a time of hormonal changes, grief and aching disappointment. But some women have a miscarriage and don't feel those things, and that's absolutely okay too. I'm on several social media pages for mums. Miscarriage is frequently discussed. I'm pregnant and there's blood. They don't know if I'm losing the baby. I've got to wait and see. There's nothing anyone can do. Does anyone have a similar experience? I actually do. About a year after my second miscarriage, I was pregnant with my daughter. I bled significantly. On 8 consecutive mornings, there was blood loss that scared me. Doctors couldn't say if I was losing her too. I prayed, and friends prayed. I'm not saying hoping or praying saves babies, because if it were that simple, none would die. I braced for another loss, trying to distract myself until I could be scanned to check I was still pregnant. I went to the scan room and was shown her heartbeat. She survived. Isabella arrived 9 years ago on Baby Loss Awareness Day, October the 15th, in her membrane sac. It's rare and said to be lucky. The midwife had never seen it. She held her up to show me, a magic water bubble, as I describe it to my kids with my baby tucked up inside. Not only did I not lose her, she was born on that significant date, after a miscarriage, in a special symbolic way. She was so safe in her protective sac, she arrived inside it and the membranes were so strong, the midwife had to pop her home so we could have a much needed cuddle. She's my rainbow baby, born after a loss, no more or less loved, wanted or important than my others, the 4 children I got to keep on earth and the 3 who couldn't stay. So let's be aware this week, this month and this year that baby loss happens, and those affected by it will always benefit from an opportunity to discuss their feelings and acknowledge it. This could be privately or publicly, alone or with others. Since moving to St Albans when I was 10, one of my favourite things to do was to light a candle in the Abbey, and I've done that for many loved ones over the years. This week, I will be doing it in memory of my missed babies. It will give me comfort, peace, and hope.
My last story is about how a local charity changed the life of street sleeper Richard. A former street sleeper has told his story as part of a campaign by Charity Emmaus to highlight the rapidly growing issue across the UK. As part of World Homeless Day on Saturday, the charity has also launched an online forum designed to bring together all the organisations working across the county to support those experiencing homelessness. The Hertfordshire Homeless Forum will run between October 10th and November 20th and will bring together several groups and organisations, including charities and housing providers. Emmaus Hertfordshire currently supports 38 people who have experienced homelessness by giving them a safe home, meaningful work in a social enterprise, and an opportunity to regain lost self-esteem to help rebuild their lives. They include Richard, who joined Emmaus Hertfordshire in 2015 after losing his home of 26 years. After becoming homeless in the middle of the winter, he spent 5 months sleeping rough in freezing conditions. Describing his time sleeping on the streets, Richard said, "Being homeless at any time is terrible, but over winter is brutal, and the physical pain is awful. The day after I was evicted, I can remember it rained heavily and I was wearing trainers with holes in. During the daytime, especially in the cold weather, you can't really lie down. I ended up walking hours every day to keep warm and became very sore doing that. I remember one night in February 2014, it was so cold that I couldn't sleep for more than 10 minutes without waking. Even then, I felt like I was being bitten all over my body." Richard moved into Emmaus Lambeth in May 2014 before arriving at Emmaus Hertfordshire in July 2015. During his time at Emmaus, he said he has found the space and stability he needs to start rebuilding his life. "Every companion at Emmaus is provided with a home for as long as they need it and are given meaningful work opportunities in one of the charity's social enterprises. For Richard, this includes collecting donations of furniture, which are sold in the charity's 5 stores across the county, and delivering items to customers. He also works in housekeeping at the Emmaus community. He is finally looking forward to the future and building a positive life for himself with the support of fellow companions and staff at Emmaus. The best thing about coming to Emmaus after 5 months on the street was simply being able to sleep in a bed again and to have a regular shower. It straight away felt like normal life had finally resumed. Since being at Emmaus, I've learned a lot of different things through working in the social enterprise. I thought I would be doing just one job all the time, but staff encourage us to try working in all the areas to see what we like best. I want to continue working on the skills I am gaining at Emmaus, and I hope to look for employment in something I can apply those skills to. Research published by Crisis in June shows a sharp increase in demand for frontline homelessness services due to the COVID-19 pandemic. More than half of frontline services surveyed saw a rise in homelessness since the start of the pandemic, and nearly three quarters reported an increase in demand for their services. As job losses continue, the ban on evictions is lifted and rough sleepers housed in temporary accommodations are forced back onto the streets, the coronavirus crisis continues to place additional pressure on people already struggling with low wages and unaffordable rent, pushing too many to the brink. Visit emmaus.org.uk/Hertfordshire to find out how you can get involved. It can be as simple as donating your unwanted furniture, old clothing or bric-a-brac, or picking up a bargain at an Emmaus shop. All the money Emmaus Hertfordshire raises in its shops goes directly towards its vital work supporting formerly homeless people in the county.
And for our last news item, runners join in Virtual Hearts 10K and Half Marathon for Hospice. Runners battled wet conditions as they took on the Hearts Virtual 10K and Half Marathon to fundraise for Rennie Grove Hospice Care. Participants were encouraged to join a virtual YouTube warm-up session on the Sunday morning with a personal trainer from Everyone Active, which was followed by a virtual countdown to make it feel as much like race day as possible. Runners shared their personal experiences by posting pictures on social media throughout the day. Those unable to join at this time were able to complete their chosen distance over the following week. All runners were asked to follow their own route and to submit their time digitally to a leaderboard. Held annually in Harpenden for the last 15 years, this year's event included the unique option of a half marathon to mark this milestone, but no one anticipated that the whole event would have to be virtual. The winners of the men's and women's virtual trophies for the half marathon were Rand Shribman and Rachel Everard. In the 10K, the men's winner was James Nelson, and coming in first for the women was Justine Anderson. In the junior division, Olivia Rust was the fastest girl, and Ewan Turner took first place for the boys. Despite the weather, feedback from runners was positive. Wet and windy, but for a very good cause, said Kerry Morgans on Twitter. Soggy Hearts virtual 10K and half marathon with friends, but we wouldn't have missed it, said Emmanuel Bentley Sanders on Facebook. Finished. Absolutely soaked, but worth it, said Mary Louise on Instagram. Hearts 10K corporate sponsors, Harpenden-based Ploughman Craven, put together a team of 39 runners, while long-serving sponsor PB Donoghue and founding sponsor Levy Associates also supported the event. Amy Chambers, head of fundraising development at Rennie Grove, said, "We would like to thank everyone involved in the Hearts 10K and half marathon. The support of our sponsors and those who took part has made it possible to raise over £43,000. This means Rennie Grove nurses can continue to care for patients now and in the future, which has never been more important than during these challenging times."
In addition to your own favourite regular programmes, time to have a look at some of the radio highlights of this coming week, starting with Saturday, October 17th. BBC Radio 4 at 9 a.m, Saturday Live. The Reverend Richard Coles is joined by Rupert Everett, who will be talking about the third volume of his memoirs, To the End of the World. Later on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. is Reading the Water. Writer, naturalist and fisherman Chris Yates returns to a secret lake to share the magic of the secluded place amid the singing of wrens and the wood pigeon's lullaby. And from here, cross to Radio 4 Extra at 4 p.m. for All Free Now. It's a drama based on Kingsley Amis's novel Girl 20, in which Sir Roy Vandervane's pursuit of stimulation wreaks havoc. Christopher Timothy and Robert Stevens star. Sunday, October 18th, Radio 3, 5:30 p.m, Words and Music, Spears, Jaguars and Eagles. Poetry, prose and music exploring the Spanish colonisation of South and Central America from the perspective of the conquistadors, the Aztecs, Incas and many more. Radio 2, 7pm, Sunday night is music night, and a very different kind of music as Ken Bruce introduces a concert from 2014 with three distinct styles of music, with tenor Alfie Bowe, Britain's Got Talent winners, with songs for musical theatre, and classical trumpet music from Matilda Lloyd. And Radio 4 Extra at 9pm, Desert Island Discs Revisited, in which Joanna Lumley talks to Kirsty Young and chooses her 8 records. On to a selection of programmes then, which are broadcast at the same time, each day, which you may enjoy. So it's the same radio station at the same time, Monday to Friday. The following are all on BBC Radio 4. Book of the Week, 9:45am, People Like Us. Barrister Hashi Mohammed reads from his account of social mobility in modern Britain. 10:45am, Clouds in Trousers, the 15-minute drama. Katie Hymn's story, which follows Zoe as she grows up with every turn in her life marked by the weather. Just after midday, Love by Roddy Doyle. Two old friends reconnect in Dublin for an evening of drinking and storytelling, trying to reconcile their versions of the past over the course of the night. Brendan Gleeson is the reader, and all those three shows on BBC Radio 4. Also at midday, on Radio 3, if you prefer something else, you'll find Composer of the Week, Monday to Friday, just after midday. This week it's Beethoven and piano sonatas. Donald MacLeod and pianist Angela Hewitt choose and discuss 5 contrasting aspects of Beethoven's piano sonatas. On to the highlights then for Monday, October 19th. And Radio 4 Extra at 10am, Major Barbara, Part 1. Bernard Shaw's classic play in which a Salvation Army missionary seeks to save the East End of London. Part 2 follows at the same time on Tuesday. Radio 4 at 3pm, Brain of Britain. Pit your wits against the 4 finalists in this nationwide general knowledge contest. And Radio 4 at 4pm presents Michael Mukpurgo's Folk Journeys. The author of Warhorse explores the way folk songs have reflected timeless human experiences and considers the conditions and historical context that gave rise to much-loved traditional songs. Tuesday, October 20th, a reminder that part 2 of Major Barbara is on Radio 4 Extra at 10am. And a familiar experience to some of us, perhaps, in the subject of Packing Up the Family Home, which is on Radio 4 at 4pm. Jeff Bird and his siblings sort through half a century's worth of stuff in their parents' house, throwing up treasures, surprises, and long-forgotten memories. Wednesday, October 21st, and we start with Radio 4 Extra at 10am, and part 1 of the classic romantic story centred around Lorna Doone. R.D. Blackmore's novel has been adapted by Barry Letts and comes vividly to life in this 1997 production. Parts 2 and 3 follow at the same time on Thursday and Friday. I'll remind you about those in a moment. Following on from the dramatic events of Lorna and the Doone family, stay tuned to Radio 4 Extra to meet some other female heroines in Unsung Heroines at 11am. Writer and comedian Viv Groskop highlights some of history's amazing unsung heroines. Thursday, October 22nd, and we'll start with Radio 4 at 11:30am, broadcasting Haunted Women, which is an eerie exploration of how women have used the ghost story form over the centuries and wonders whether the worlds of haunted houses and female ghosts presents a lens through which to explore women's experiences. Don't forget it's part 2 of Lorna Doone on Radio 4 Extra at 10am. And the ghost theme is taken up in a very different sense at 3pm on Radio 4 in Ghost Ponds and Underwater Songs. In this open country episode, we learn how local farmer Richard Waddingham set about restoring the ponds on his land, which inspired the Norfolk Ponds Project, dedicated to reversing their decline and providing vital habitats for aquatic biodiversity. Finally for this week, Friday, October 23rd, and remember again, part 3 of the final episode of Lorna Doone is on Radio 4 Extra at 10am. Perhaps the dramatisation of that will feature on Feedback at 4:30pm on Radio 4, the programme which gives us, the listeners, the chance to air our views on BBC radio programmes. If not, it's still worth listening to for those of us whom the radio is an essential part of our lives. If the composer of the week, Beethoven, recommended as our regular daily listen earlier on in these listings, was not to your taste, you may prefer to take a trip down memory lane and tune in to Radio 2 at 7 p.m. for Tony Blackburn's Golden Hour, where you'll find pop and soul oldies with, among others, The Supremes, Manfred Mann and The Village People. Whatever your taste in music, drama, literature and documentary, we hope you have found something of interest in these listings. As ever, stay safe, stay well and happy listening.
And now we have the concluding parts of the virtual tour of St Albans Museum and Gallery, which myself and Ian included the first two parts of last month.
My name's Sarah Keeling. I'm curator here at St Albans Museum and Gallery, and I've been asked to give you a tour of the building. Last week we looked at the courtroom, and now I have headed down the main stairs of the museum past the honours board, which celebrate all of the people who donated to us when we were refurbishing the building. And I've stepped into the stele corridor. Now, this is a really narrow corridor with bricks. It's the only part of the building we weren't able to make fully accessible because of the steps and because of its narrowness. And you can walk along this corridor, and at the end, you see the cell doors. We've left two of these cells as they were when the building was last used as holding cells, and we've also left the guard cell so that you can explore it. But the rest of them have become the most unusual toilets in St Albans. So if you've ever fancied what it is like to be locked inside a cell, but you want to lock yourself in, this is the place to come. The two cells that we have left as they were, you can come into and you can shut the door to see just how small they are. Now, of course, you weren't going to be in here for a long time. These are holding cells for the court. This wasn't where you were going to be kept imprisoned. This was where you waited to hear your fate and to have your case heard. They're still quite unnerving because, of course, it's quite echoey, as you can probably hear, and that means you would be able to hear all of the footsteps from the courtroom above and also along the corridor as you waited for someone to come and get you. The other lovely thing to do in here is to look at the doors and to see the graffiti. You'll notice that there are still some names on the back of the doors and dates, normally in the 1960s. And what that means is that we can see the names of some of those final people who were held here waiting for their trials. And I know that there are some of those people who are still living in St Albans today. We haven't managed to match any of them up with the graffiti, but I have met the occasional person who says the last time they were in this building, it was up in front of the magistrates. If you look along the corridor outside the cells to the left, you can see a door that then goes up to a staircase, and that takes you to the back of the building and what's now a fire escape, but was originally the main entrance for prisoners to come. If you want to walk between the back of the museum and gallery and the buildings immediately behind it along that alleyway and look at the railings, you'll see that they look a little bit strange. And the reason for that is that they were originally designed to be a gate that could be swung across the alleyway to shut it off when prisoners were being brought from the police station that was in that building immediately behind us down into the holding cells so that they couldn't run away. It didn't entirely work. In 1849, we know that a man called Cooper was arrested, and as he was being brought away, he attacked the constables with their own truncheons and managed to hit one of them over the head. So it wasn't always successful. Another problem with having a prison with holding cells in the centre of town is that people would occasionally try to pass food and even liquor down into the cells. So they had to make sure that they had the grills fixed all around the cells to stop that from happening. So it is quite a strange space down here, but it's well worth a look. Being able to open this up regularly to people was one of the great things about opening the museum and gallery previously. You could come down here on one of the city tour guides tours, but for most people it was out of access. I'm walking back along the corridor now, and I'm going to take you into the new room that we created, the Western Gallery. Immediately outside, if you look up, you can see some vaulted brick ceilings. That's part of the old building still. There was a pantry down here and a kitchen and stores, a wine cellar even, for some of those events upstairs. But through the doors, you're into a brand new space that was dug out as part of the Heritage Funded project. To make this room, it was an incredibly slow and careful process. The building, as we've talked about before, is Grade 2 star listed, so it had to be carefully protected. And what they did was they removed the floor of the entranceway
and then dug down. And they had to dig around the sides of the room first, carefully in different sections to underpin the foundations, and then dig out the earth in the centre. There are some amazing photographs on our website, if you search for the story so far, where you can see this space when it was two stories high, when you could stand on the floor of the Western Gallery and see up to the entrance and out. And it also shows some of the brickwork of the original foundations. We're quite often asked if anything exciting was found when they dug out all that earth. The answer is not really. Mostly it was some animal bone and one shoe. Of course, where we are now is on the site of the market. There were some almshouses here as well, but this isn't a place that had a lot of big buildings before. It was the market. It has always been that centre of the town. So we didn't find anything exciting, which you could say is sad, but also meant that we were able to stay on track and open in June 2018. The space is empty at the moment. We were due to be opening the first Hertfordshire Open just as lockdown started. And of course, we had to cancel that. We had some amazing entries for that show. It's very sad not to show them in person, but actually we've been able to celebrate the talent of Hertfordshire artists much more widely by putting it onto our website and the UH Arts website as well. They have curated the show for us. Just before that, we had the Science in St Albans exhibition, and it's a really good example of a show that would have been difficult to do before. We had a lot of our insects from our collection on display, talking about Eleanor Ormerod, who was a local entomologist. That's someone who studies insects. And we were able to do that because we could control the light in here and also the humidity and the temperature to an exact degree. And that's what a new space gives us. Also, because we had the nice big space, we were able to have the Wallingford clock on display, which is usually in St Albans Cathedral and is a model of a very early medieval clock. Other exhibitions we've had in this space are the Barbara Hepworth, which was an amazing exhibition, and I loved coming into it to see it while it was on here, to see her sculpture and to see her beautiful paintings. Again, we'd never have been able to borrow those before without the security and the ability to control the temperature and the light in here. And to celebrate her connection to Hertfordshire and the pieces that she made for the university and also for Marlborough School was really exciting. And we were able, back when we opened, to borrow the Book of St Albans, which is one of the earliest printed colour books in the country, printed on a press here in St Albans, the third printing press in the country. So it's been really exciting to see what we can do with the space. And as a curator standing here in the empty room, it's sad to see it empty of all of our collections and other people, but it's also really exciting to start to think about what you might be going to see when you come back. We have sort of one to two exhibitions here. They're big exhibitions and they take a lot of time to think about and plan, but we've got some really exciting ideas coming up. So we're looking forward to welcoming you back to see those.
I'm standing on the grand staircase at the moment. This staircase was put in 1914. Before that, there was a much smaller staircase that took people from the ground floor up. But now we have this glorious sweeping staircase that can work amazingly well when you've got an event here, and which we use now as a portrait gallery to show off some of the well-known people of St Albans, past and present, St Albans and the district, I should say. We have people like Eric Morecambe and his connection to Harpenden. We have Jim Rodford of the Zombies, who I know a lot of people in St Albans remember very affectionately, well, not just in St Albans, worldwide. We've got Stephen Hawking, who is at school here, and several others. We are currently looking through all the suggestions that have come in for additional people, and we're hoping that when you come back into the building, we might have a couple of extras to add. At the top of the stairs is our St Albans On Demand Gallery. This is a space where people can request a specific object or a story or a group that they want us to celebrate, or where we can commemorate particular anniversaries. So before we closed for lockdown, we had a display of the Royal National Lifeboat Institute St Albans, because we've had a branch of the RNLI for 100 years, which is something I think that not many residents of St Albans know. But also we've had on display the Normandy Veterans Association of St Albans flag since the D-Day anniversary last year. We can, however, cross the landing gallery and come into the most glorious space in the building, in my opinion, the assembly room. You can probably hear my voice change as we come into this echoey space. The assembly room is, as it was when it opened, a space that can transform itself very quickly. It's a beautiful room with stucco plasterwork and wreaths and gilding and two beautiful fireplaces. But this room can be everything from a council meeting space or a lecture hall to an exhibition installation space to a party venue, a disco venue, a concert venue. Since we reopened, we've had weddings and bar mitzvahs and birthdays
birthday parties. We had Liz West's incredible installation, Our Colour Reflection, which had these beautiful coloured discs which transformed the whole room and just made it look completely different. And then just before we closed, we had secondary schools in St Albans brought some of the work from their sixth form students, and we had a display of that. I hope some of you at home are sitting there thinking that you can think of events that might want to happen here. It's a space that people can hire to hold their own events. And also we've got a few plans coming up for things to do over the next year, hopefully when we can show it off again. But it has always been a changing space. And one of the things I've loved is being able to bring back some of its past functions. So we know in the late 1800s, there was a planetarium in here. And during our science exhibition last year, we were able to bring back an inflatable planetarium. And I just like to imagine those people who came in the 1800s and saw the representations of the planets, how amazed they would have been to have seen the more recent version showing man landing on the moon. So hopefully we'll be able to continue to do that, to bring back some of that past function and also to find new ways that we can use this room. I'm upstairs and I'm in the wet glazed link. That is the corridor that joins the assembly room at the front of the building to the keeper's galleries at the back of the building. If I'd been here before our heritage funded project, I'd be standing outside on the roof right now, so I'm quite glad to be inside. The glazed links allow you to look down on the city from a bird's eye view. So today I can see just a few people walking around in small groups, and it's really nice to see people in the city centre again. But normally you can look down on the market and the bustle of St Albans from this side, from the market side. And on the other side of the building, you can look and see the whole length of Holywell Hill from Chequer Street and all of the buildings along that road, lots of which were previously coaching inns and staging posts on the route out of London. A couple of other things you can see from these glazed links. On the marketplace side, you can look at Upper Dagnall Street and the W.H. Smith building on the corner, and that was the previous town hall before this one. So you can see quite easily why they needed more space for the town hall and the court and why they wanted to move in here. But it's nice to be able to see that just across the road. My other favourite thing to do in these links is to look down into the courtroom. You can see people having their cups of tea and coffee and cake, but also you can see if anyone's on trial in the dock. Fairly frequently, you will see friends or family trying their loved ones from the dock and the magistrate's seat, which is always fun to see. You can then carry on down the corridor and you finish in the keeper's galleries. So I'm just going to go through the door. The keeper's galleries were named after the keeper or caretaker of the building who would have lived here originally. You can get to the rest of the building by a back staircase that takes you all the way straight down to the cells or just down to the back of the building. So we named these galleries after the keeper. Right now, what I'm looking at is the Handy Page exhibition, which opened just before we went into lockdown. Handy Page are an aircraft manufacturer who worked out of Radlett Aerodrome, and the exhibition tells their story and about all of the planes that they created, the ones that were used in the First World War, the Second World War, leisure planes, the ones that might have taken you on your holidays in the 1960s and 70s, the connections to the Berlin Airlift, which I discovered when working on this exhibition. If you are interested in Handy Page, do look on our website because we've moved the exhibition online. We hope that when we reopen, we'll be able to have this exhibition open for a little bit longer as well so we can show it off, but do have a look online. Other exhibitions we've had in this space before include the work of Jane Glynn and Suman Gujaral, who are two local artists whose show Imprinted was here in 2019. We've also very recently had an exhibition about the St Albans pageants, which took place in the early 1900s. And also then a bit later into the middle of the century. And I know that there are some residents in St Albans who remember those pageants and the costumes and the incredible work that went into them. We were very lucky that Trestle Theatre worked with us to do a little bit of a re-performance of one of them as well. I'm working at the moment on what will be our programme for the next year or two. We aim to have about 4 exhibitions in here, and I'm working with a whole range of community groups, historians and artists. I'm not going to tell you what's coming up, I'm afraid you'll have to wait and see, but it's a really exciting programme. And this is where I'm going to finish our building tour, as we have been round, I think, just about every space in the building. We're really looking forward to welcoming you back when we're able to, and I hope it's been interesting to hear a little bit about the history of the building.
We have now come to the end of this recording. So from Kalpana, Peter, Alison, Claire and John, and from me, Alex, goodbye, stay safe, and here's to the next time.